Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Hello, hello, hello. Nice one, JP. Good evening. You are welcome to Dolphin Rugby Club. We're broadcasting live from the heart of Cork City. It is brilliant to be here. Thank you all for coming out. It's pretty miserable. Is it the J2s that are just about to play? Just down to our right-hand side, we're overlooking Musgrave Park here in Dolphins Clubhouse. So hopefully the lads will come in afterwards. Have they a match or are they just out training? Match this evening, league match. So we'll bring you live updates throughout the evening of the Junior 2 league match. Don't you worry about that. They're looking a little bit nervous down there. We might even do live commentary if it comes to it a little bit later on. We're delighted to be here. We're going to talk about the history of Dolphin over the next hour or so. This is a club with a brilliant history, with some great names that are provided for Ireland and for Munster, and continue to this day with the Scannels and with Darren Sweet in them. We're going to look ahead to Munster's game against Cass with Johnny Murphy in a little while. But I want to get our big names out on stage right away because Mick Galway and Gary Halpin are here. Give it up for the two lads. We are here tonight with thanks to Heineken Rugby Club. Fans get more out of the game, exclusive member-only events, just like this one, and tickets to the Heineken Champions Cup. You can all join today on HeinekenRugbyClub.com, or if you want to get in touch, if you have any questions for the lads, 53106 is the text number, or use the hashtag OTBHRC, and we already have one wondering if you can have a drink and go to the bar while the show is on. You can, as long as you buy one for the lads as well. Lads, thanks a lot for coming down. Gary, you have a good history, not just with this club, but with this particular room.
Yes, indeed. It's very strange coming back here tonight because in 1983, I met my wife just where that girl in the grey sweater is sitting down there, if you put up your hand, and my wife is with us here tonight. So I have Dolphin Rugby Club always holds a place in my heart. My very first rugby coach was a past president of here, a chap called Val Murphy, who was passed away tragically a number of years ago with the club. And
there's a picture of Val.
Yeah, a picture of Val on the wall there, and we remember him. But the happiest thing about me here tonight is I was really delighted tonight to be invited here with Mick Galway, because I'm sick of sitting beside people like Dennis Hickey, because when I'm sitting beside Mick Galway, the more you look at me, the better looking I start becoming during the course of the night. So I'm very happy
all
about
right.
that. It's lovely
Gary,
to be
we're
here.
On radio. Don't worry about it, Ken. Right. There's no cameras there.
We are streaming live on all our social channels as well. Okay. If you want to get a look at the two ads.
We'll have a vote. We'll have a vote.
Was that also the case, Gary, the night you met your wife?
I take it the lights were that.
Yeah, it was. You know the way it was back in the 80s. You always had the slow sets. You know, they dimmed the lights for three songs, and there was a specific order. You know, three songs.
You remember the songs?
If you stuck around for three songs, you were a happy man then. Yeah, but the lights probably were dimmed quite a bit.
So talk us through this. Were you downplaying a match that day, and you hung around for the after party?
Yeah, we had played against the Welsh schoolboys here in that day, and we played out here in Musgrave Park. And the entertainment and the disco was on here that night. So, but back then in the club, I always remember I had been in school in Rockwell, and we used to come down here for weekends. And at that stage, this was one of the most happening places in Cork City for kids between the ages of about 14 and 18, you know. So it was a great place to be. So I do.
Is it still?
So I do feel a very big affinity to the place. I was very friendly with Terry Kingston down through the years, and in the Christmas holidays, I used to come down and train with the club occasionally, and, you know, Phil O'Callaghan's dog didn't know me, so he just ran around barking and biting at me all day, you know, so it goes back quite a long time.
So you learned everything in the Dolphin tradition?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I had obviously many friends from here. Some of my biggest fear factors, I think, in rugby start here. There used to be a character here called the second row, Tom Kyo was his name, you know. And I was in I was playing in Wanderers, and Tom Keogh, you know, had a face that was tailor-made for radio. There was no doubt about it. As a kid, I remember I was about 22 years of age. I'd never seen a broken nose like this in my life. It was like someone put him through a liquidizer. But he was a cracking guy off the field. But I remember coming down here with Wanderers years ago, and we'd had a few good seasons, and we were all feeling pretty good about
ourselves. Wouldn't be fond of the Wanderers
fellas. No, he wasn't great with the Wanderers fellas. But in the middle of a lineout, he knocked me into the middle of next week, you know. And a couple of moments later, I woke up and I could feel the grass on the back of your neck. And you, that's how you knew you were concussed back in those days, by the way. You know, there was no sort of examinations for 15 minutes or anything. But no, I always remember Tom very fondly as well. You know, good character.
I'd say been in the front row. I'd say been in a scrum in the club game back in the late 80s was an interesting place.
Yeah, it was, because, you know, it's very strange to see it now, the way it's so controlled and set. But back in the day, as many of you here will know, we were literally jogging into it. You know, it was a ready, steady go, you know. And you were quite literally, there was thudding heads and all sorts going on. So it's, you know, it is obviously very different today. So.
And were there different styles of scrummaging as you went from, say, Dublin down to Cork?
Yeah, it tended to get filthier the farther south you went, you know. It tended to get filthier. This guy here, I remember, I had a terrible... I remember with Marcus Horan out here one day, yeah, you know, and I was kind of on the bench for Leinster at that stage. I was kind of coming to the end of my tether. And there was this young kid called Marcus Horan playing for Munster. And I was called on. I was like, I'm going to sew this kid up in a minute, you know. And he was pushing behind Marcus Horan. But before, and he realized Horan was young against him now. But the first thing I did when I got into the scrum was get a box right into the face from this guy.
That was Marcus. Yeah. That was Marcus.
No, and we were on the Munster 5-yard line. I went down. We got penalized. He was laughing at me, and Munster kicked themselves out of trouble. So there you go.
Every story you hear about you seems to end with you laughing about the situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's important. You have to have a sense of humour in this old game, you know. Firstly, it's great to be here. I've great memories of Dolphin, and particularly being in this clubhouse. Unlike Gary, I didn't meet my wife here, but I've had some great nights here. But I would have gone back. Even my first time playing against Dolphin would have been with Castle Island.
Right.
And minor A, I don't know, is it still minor rugby or is it junior? Yeah, but it was minor A back then. So when I started playing rugby first, it was with Castle Island. Then obviously I moved to Shannon, and then we would have been playing against Dolphin in AIL and what have you. And, you know, before AIL even, would have been Munster Senior Cup or Munster League or whatever. And I remember often coming down here and having some great matches and great tussles. And yes, Gary mentioned Tom Keogh, you know, what a warrior like. And I played with him at Munster as well, but he was real old school. Like, we all think we're old school, but Tom was old school. Like, he was just fantastic. Tom had this
What's
great face.
What's old school?
Tom had this, like, there was this thing.
School.
There was something about Tom that he, you know, he was probably thinking as a modern day rugby player, but he was forced every second ruck. You know, that's the way they looked at Tom. So he was just, he'd hit a ruck and he'd give the next one a miss and then he'd hit the next one. Now, as it happened, he was ahead of his time, because that's the way the game has gone. But Tom was a great character. But I got my first captain, Michael Kiernan, who came from this club, obviously. I played with Terry Kingston. Played with Paul McCarthy before he took the soup and went over to Carcon. But that's another story, you know.
Well, here we go. It's starting.
And I hope he's listening, by the way.
I always reckon that was a great move for him. He robbed about five caps from me in the process as well.
Yeah. And Gussie Ahern, I would have played with Gussie. And Jack Clark. Myself and Jack Clark were both kind of dropped off the Irish team, like, usually around the same time. And, you know, particularly the early 90s, which wasn't a good time for Irish rugby. But, some great memories of not alone being here in Dolphin, but being in Musgrave Park as well. You know, it's great. Looking out at the pitch now, the place is looking fantastic. I don't know, like, and it was never a bad pitch. It was one of the better pitches, to be honest. Like, it was, any time you ever came to Musgrave Park, the pitch was in good nick, but it's obviously got that 4G thing there now. Thank God it wasn't in our day, Gary. Why we never have stood up to that.
But we'd have to run faster.
Absolutely, we'd have to run. We'd have to run, full stop. But, no, it is great. And look, and I think it's a credit to Dolphin. The place hasn't changed a bit. I haven't been here in a while, and It's looking well though, by the way. Don't get me wrong, it's looking great.
I can't wait for the disco to start.
Absolutely, yeah. Dim the lights. But no, it's great. It's good to be here. And as I said, I've had great friends with Dolphin. And I suppose particularly maybe one of my favourite games here, and Terry Kingston was captain the same day, it was the day Munster beat Australia, you know. That was a 92. That wasn't pretty now, to be honest. But we won the match, you know, yeah. And we won it in the way we had to win it. Australia were coming as world champions. They had just toured South Africa. They were unbeaten over there, and they had this thing that their second team was every bit as good as their first team. And I remember we had a few injuries with Munster, but and we hadn't gone well in the Interpros. And the previous year, or whatever, like this is long before EIL and God knows what. No, it was the start of EIL, sorry. But Young Munster were going well at the time. I mean, you had two Clahasies playing. You had Gerald's playing, Keith's father. You had Derek Tobin. You know what I mean? So you had a good few lads from Young Munster. You had a few athletes like myself, obviously, playing and that. But we just had a hand-picked team that was... We probably didn't realise it at the time, but we were good enough to beat the world champions. And I got sent off for some reason that day, I don't know. But obviously, this was long before TMO and...
To protect yourself.
Protect myself. People said Clash should have been jailed after, but that's another story.
Who was the Australian sent off with you?
Garrick Morgan, yeah. That's Garrick Morgan, yeah. Probably the biggest fella on the field. Like, but yeah. That's what you do when a scrap starts, pick up the big fella. It's very seldom I get an opportunity to do that, but I did it that day.
I played with him for 2 years in Harlequins, though. He always spoke very highly
of you. I'm sure he did, yeah. Wish him happy Christmas for
you.
It was a strange quirk that Terry Kingston in 92 captained against Australia, and then James Collin was one of the Munster captains against Australia in 2010, another great former Dolphin player as well. Obviously, unfortunately for your generation, everything that comes after the victory over the All Blacks is probably lost, and those incredible, going and beating a touring Australian side. Were they a shot to nothing, those games?
Well, they were, I suppose, in some ways. I remember as players and probably as a province, we were a bit pissed off with the whole thing because Leinster and Ulster got the Saturday games. This was the good old days when you'd have a touring side coming and they'd obviously be the test match and they'd play the three provinces. And, you know, so we didn't get the Saturday game, so we were a bit, you know, pissed off with that. We got a Wednesday game in between the matches or a Tuesday game, I forget what it was. So that, you know, all we needed is a cause, you know yourself, like, you know, that's all we needed. But but it was great, like, and unfortunately that's something you don't see in the professional game now. There's some fantastic players that will never get the opportunity, I suppose, to play against the touring sides, and it's a thing of the past. Like, you would have played against
played against a touring New Zealand team with Leinster, but still, this was something that was much discussed after the victory, is that so many players are losing out without these Wednesday games anymore, but, you know, bigger things decide those things. But
while we're talking about Dolphin greats then, on Terry Kingston, I'm sure you played against him a lot at club level.
I probably got the majority of my caps with Terry Kingston, you know, and my playing career goes, I started playing with Terry first when I was about 14, you know, and he was... Terry was, we used to call him the Bulldog, you know, when we were playing, because he was such a ferocious character, and the way he loved the game, the way he got stuck into the game all the time. And he was a great team man to boot, you know, and I know he led the club here with distinction for a long, long time. Good fella, you know.
I want to go down to the crowd, actually. Ronan, I think you have the mic there, because I want to talk to the woman who's currently leading the club, Suzanne Reedy Murphy, the current club chairwoman. Thanks a lot for joining us this evening, and thanks for hosting us here
You're
in Dolphin.
Very welcome, very welcome. We're delighted to welcome the Off the Ball and to all of you, to the audience, for coming along. So what can I say about...
Is the club in good health right now?
It's in very good health, thank you. We're in a perfect grounds as well, and we have a very busy team of people behind the club, very loyal and very committed members, and I have to say, getting stronger every day. We have fantastic bar team running the bar for the Munster matches that are all homegrown, all our own club members and all our own 20s team, all the students, they all work in the bar here. So it's all Dolphin people running the show, which is fantastic, you know. And I suppose we start with our minis, if I can say that. Our minis coaches are here tonight giving great example, holding up the bar. Preparing for tomorrow morning's onslaught of youth.
You need
our minis. And our youth are undergoing a lot of work and rebuilding the youth section here, which is fantastic as well. And a lot of people putting a lot of effort in. Our director of rugby isn't here tonight. John Hearn, Gus's brother, is our director of rugby this year. And we have a great 20s team, but our J2s that are playing out there tonight, I asked one of them today, how would you like to be described? He said, old. So we wish them well tonight, and our senior captain, Daryl Foley, is here tonight, and we wish them well tomorrow against UL Bowes in the league. Our senior seconds are playing there as well tomorrow. But we have a great club. We've upgraded all our plumbing, as the fellow said. The showers are working well. new boilers, new keg room. And
they don't want for anything.
Lots of support. They don't want for anything, really. I think they're all very happy playing here. And we've attracted a lot of players in the last couple of months as well. So it's been great.
Gary, of course, mentioned the dirty word. Cork Con.
Oh, yes.
Talk to us about this rivalry, because this is one of these rivalries, I guess, when we talk about cities and clubs against each other, people usually laugh and joke and go, out as a good rivalry. I think this is a proper, deep-rooted... There's a little bit of hatred in there between the two.
I say any more. Like, I don't know about hatred, but there certainly was a rivalry. It kind of started...
Where did it start?
In 1955, my parents got married, and my mother was a Cork Con woman, reared there, and my father was Dolphin.
Whoa.
Came straight from Christians out to Dolphin, but they married in 55, and it meant that Jim Kieran and her brother came to Dolphin, Mick's dad, and it split the two brothers. So Tom Kieran stayed in Con, and Jim came here. And my mother's uncles never spoke to her again.
Really?
Never.
Fantastic.
My granduncles.
That's the kind of commitment you
that's
want to see.
That's lovely. I like that.
Yeah,
I like that.
Con did give them a lovely clock for their wedding, but I think that was just marking time in some other way. Yeah. But she had been in the catering side of things in Cork Con for years, and came here and was on the catering committee here and led a team of very dedicated women that were all wives of players or our committee at the time. And went on for 30 years, and both of them are gone now. And I got back involved after my dad died 6 years ago, and mum 2.5 years ago. So I've been kind of clubhouse chairman here, and was made president last year. And
brilliant.
So, I'm following in dad's footsteps. He was president here twice. And I suppose he was president of the IRFU and that kind of stuff. So administration kind of side of things is in the blood as well, I suppose.
You mentioned Michael Kiernan there, and I'm sure you take great pride as you've spoken about the underage level and the kids that are coming through, but also for every club, seeing players put on the provincial jersey, and there've been countless players who played
for
Munster.
Yeah.
Through to this day, they'll be playing on Sunday. The two Scannels are in the Munster side. They're playing with the Ireland team. Darren Sweetenham has been involved with the Ireland team lately as well. Yeah. But I do want to play you the video of the drop goal against England to win the 1985 Triple Crown, scored by Dolphins, Michael Kiernan.
In go the Irish scores. This is Lenehan bursting into the 22. Back to Bradley. Back to Kiernan. The drop of goal is on.
A commentary by Fred Cogley. What are your memories of that day?
Very proud. I think the proudest moment, I suppose, was his first cap, which was in Twickenham. And he came on for David Irwin, who went off with a broken leg, I think, at the time. It was a broken leg. And all the family were there. His mum, all of us were drinking champagne out in the car park beforehand. And missed a lot of the match, I have to say.
The original tailgaters.
We did see him coming on, and it was fantastic. And he has brought great pride, as all our internationals have, to the club. I think it would be lovely to see their names still after their, or the club names still after their own names, when the programme, and I've said this in recent times, that the club takes pride in them, they take pride in the club. They're reared and they're coached out here, and it would be fantastic to see their name and not to have them sign with the First Division club. And it's not just because we're 2A this year, but, you know, it means all of the clubs take pride.
Absolutely.
And their family are connected to us. The Scannels, the sponsorship is here. The O'Sullivan's Pharmacy are one of our sponsors. Kiri's been our main sponsor, but O'Sullivan's are involved, and that's the Scannels' mum, you know. So we would like to see their name, the Dolphin name, after that. I think there's a great swell of pride when you see that at an international match, and you want that affinity, you know.
Yeah.
So
put it in the match programme.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll do everybody.
More Dolphin and less Con.
Michael Kiernan was a great guy in my early career. I would have said, if you remember back, Michael, there used to be a sort of a senior junior player thing within the national setup. And I know that in terms of playing, senior members are very important, but it was always kind of hard to get into that group. But Michael Kiernan was one of the guys who really befriended the younger guys, you know. And he was selfless with his time, talking to people and sort of bringing you along. And I remember that great story. Michael Kiernan, I had just come back from America as a hammer thrower when I came back into rugby. So I'd had this whole life of, you know, almost nigh on professional sport. And I remember Michael Kiernan telling me, like, the scariest thing he ever saw in rugby. And I was like, Jesus, what was that? And he says, I came back from a tour in Romania 2 years ago, and he said, do you know how strong the drink is in Romania? And I said, I do know how strong it is. He said, the scariest thing I ever saw, I was put rooming with Paco Fitzgerald, Claw, and Michael Galway. And I came in at 2 o'clock in the morning, I saw the most horrific thing in my life. He said, Paco was puking out the window of the hotel. Peter Clossy was sitting in the toilet, crapping himself and puking himself to death. And Michael Galway was lying passed out in his bed with a line of vomit from his mouth across the bed and into his gear bag.
But the question I have to ask, where was Michael Kiernan until 2 in the morning? We were tucked up in bed.
We were absolutely, yeah.
That wasn't the time you lost
tucked
the tooth,
up in
was
bed,
it?
Yeah. No, yeah. We lost the tooth on a few occasions, but no, not that time. Not that time.
You would have found it quickly. Anesthetic when you want to go to Romania, eh? There you go.
Let's play another video. This one you're going to like, I think, Gary. 1995, New Zealand. The try. Is this the best moment of your career? Let's watch it first.
Yeah. I think I won for the score, Richard. Let's move and ball in the ball.
The most amazing.
Well, that's look into my eyes, is it?
Yeah. Did you see the way my hair was flowing as I went over the try? The most amazing thing about that try, first of all, is the fact I caught it. Remember? Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you see what
we've been practicing that for about 2 years. He's off every time.
But what people don't understand, like in that game, Lomo was there. I sidestepped Lomo 3 times during the course of that game, and that's true. The only problem was he was the one carrying the ball at that stage. Oh, yeah. But the one thing I realised, because, you know, when you're in rugby, over here it's very easy to appreciate rivalries. But, you know, we got that big rivalry against the English, and it works so much. Irish teams get an extra 10-15% into dressing rooms, but you can't believe how much the South Africans hate the New Zealanders, right? And after that summer, after that World Cup, I took a trip around South Africa and Zimbabwe. And I couldn't go into a pub and put my hand into my pocket because South Africans, I must have put on about 4 stone, well, 2 stone in the summer after that, because the South Africans absolutely love that whole thing, you know. So, I mean, what Andy Warhol said, everybody's, 15 seconds of fame? There you go. That was mine. So it was good fun.
You still haven't explained why you did it, though. Why did you give...
Oh, sorry, sorry.
Was that aimed at the New Zealand,
you know,
supporters
every time
or
I
New
see
Zealand
him
players?
Oh, sorry. It's Sean Fitzpatrick. Every time I see him, I still want to give him the finger. You know what I mean? I find him... You know, he's a great player and all that.
Tonight's a prize guest.
Yeah. But you know, I hated playing against Kiwis because they were always talking about moves on the inside. They're just talking about rugby all the time. And they talk about things like rugby and fly fishing and crap like that. You know, they just...
Sheep, of course,
you know. No, but they were just... I don't know, in a moment like that, I suppose it was just, a bit of a rush of blood to the head, they would say. But, you know, we were... You see, the thing about it then, as Mike alluded to earlier on, in that competition, these guys were sold to us as almost unstoppable in that competition.
Absolutely.
And they proved to be unstoppable right to that last hurdle. But that was the first time I did the Haka against, you know, looking at him, the size of him, and it's... And it's a weird thing in rugby. As a young guy looking at it, I always remember it was like, they get a real psychological advantage over us, and why can't we do something like that? And Riverdance was big then, right? So I was like, why don't we all start giving it a bit of that to them, you know? I bet that would frighten the crap out of them, you know?
That would scare them.
Yeah.
That would scare the shit out of them.
Yeah, we could laugh them to death or something like that, you know?
What did you do, just stand there?
I think we just stood. You were dropped for that
one.
Yeah. Sorry. We've been dropped.
Maybe tweed got that one.
Standing again. Yeah, it was. I think we just stood there pretty still and just tried to concentrate. Andrew Murthens in the All Black haka, and it goes. Yeah, there's always some guy who looks a bit sort of meek or something. Andrew Murthens was standing with his hands like that. So Nick Popplewell had warned me. He'd been on the Lions tour or something but a year or two before. So we all sort of concentrated on Andrew Murthens because he was the least offensive looking, I suppose, you know.
He was the smallest fella.
Yeah, he was a small, he was a little small blonde fella, you know.
We've got to the stage where obviously we've now finally got the measure of New Zealand, and there's absolutely no fear amongst Irish players of going up against the Kiwis. But I was going to ask, in 95, did you have that? But then you played them in 92 down in Dunedin, where really, like, any curse that was there should have been ended that day. You ran them incredibly close.
We bought tour to 92, and again, back in the great tours, I think that tour lasted about 8 matches, you know what I mean? So you were there for, you know, well over a month, probably 6 weeks. And I remember we got hammered in a few matches. Remember we played Auckland and we played Canterbury, and geez, they really put it into us. But for the first test, I'd say they thought they were going to hammer us, you know what I mean? It was in Dunedin, the House of Pain, and in fairness, we actually got it together. And with a couple of minutes to go, we were leading 19-15 or something. And this is back in the day when the try was worth 4 points, and they got a late try to beat us, like, you know what I mean? And we were obviously distraught because it was our one chance that we thought we might beat the All Blacks. But the big mistake we made then, of course, is we nearly have to beat them this week, so we'll definitely beat them next week, you know what I mean? We're after upsetting them, like. And the following week, we're playing them in Wellington, windy Wellington, we'll never forget it. And God rest them, and Neville Furlong, who passed away there 2 years ago, poor old Neville, scored the first try, and his leg was actually broke. Do you remember? His leg was actually broke. And he made out a pass John Kerwin, like, he had a big, you know, back in the day when... You didn't
play for Ireland with a broken leg.
Oh yeah, well, do you remember when you used to, like, now you strap the legs before you strap the boot and the whole lot around the leg. You know what I mean? But he actually scored in the corner, and we get the conversion. We're up 6-0. Happy days, like, you know what I mean? They beat us 59-6 the same day, right? We got hammered.
The scariest thing I think I've seen in a rugby match,
aside
from Tom Kuehl,
is
that in the middle of that game, Stevie Smith punched Sean Fitzpatrick in the face, and Sean Fitzpatrick stopped the game and went over to the sideline and just took his tooth out of his own head.
Two front teeth. Handed
them to the physio, and we were going, oh my Jesus. And I was on the bench. Yeah. Oh, I don't want to come on today.
And you know what? He came back on and got man of the match. That's the scary thing about him.
Yeah.
But it was very funny after. I remember...
Smile in the picture.
That was a record. That was a record for years. And another great man, of course, Talfa, we never mentioned, was Declan Kidney. Declan Kidney was coach in Ireland a number of years after. And they got hockeyed as well below New Zealand. You know what I mean? Of course, I rang Declan and said, look, hard luck, but thanks for taking the monkey off our back, because they had now got the new record. And of course, Declan being Declan, well, it wasn't like that. In your time, the try was only about 4 points, so they technically beat you more. I said, Declan, doesn't matter, know what. It's the numbers that count, so thank God. Thanks for that, Declan. He did some great things for me, but that was probably the best thing he ever did.
In that game, I remember, in that game, it was Ronnie Carey, the winner.
Ronnie Carey, yeah.
So closely, you know, nearly pulled in an interception.
One of those intercepts where you catch it, you tip three times, and then it hits the ground. Like, if he had got it, This is the first game.
This is
the first game. Yeah. The last few minutes, we would have beaten the All Blacks. Two were probably all over, like, which we wouldn't have turned off for the sex. You remember? Sorry, lads.
Do you remember?
Injured, lads. Sorry. Yeah.
Do you remember?
He can have it. One on. We'll leave it at that, lads. Yeah.
Do you remember, there's a great, remember Paul Mack in the aftermath, in the meeting? McCarthy, the ex-Dolphin.
We talked to Soup, Jim.
Yeah, Cork Con, we were talking about him earlier on. We used to have these meetings, and we'd only used to be able to turn up for the meetings on about Tuesday from the piss-up that you'd have to the next sort of training session. And we were in these circles about how we were going to beat the All Blacks. We only lost to them by a point. And everybody's pitching in something right now. Macker used to fix washing machines around Cork City. That's what he did for his job back then, you know. And he wasn't saying a word, and he was playing. And all of a sudden, Macker pipes up and says, he says, the New Zealanders are going to be wrecked next week. They're going to be bollocksed, he said. And we were like, how do you know that? Like, what is it? He says, I was talking to half of them after the match, and apparently most of them are on nights next week, he said to me. And Kieran Fitzgerald, who had very little sense of humour back then, you know, it didn't go down too well. Anyway, there you go. But that's a true story about Macker, you know.
Yeah.
And when you're in that dressing room afterwards, are you devastated that you've missed out on this chance to beat the All Blacks?
Yeah,
the way you talk about it now, we genuinely
knew it was an opportunity. You know what I mean? We genuinely knew there was a chance there. But the little fella in the back of your head is telling you, look, we'll do it again next week. But you know, looking back on it, we're only fooling ourselves. And in fairness to Nigel Noel at the time, who was manager, he did say to us, beware of a wounded All Black. You know, he did say that, beware of a wounded All Black. And to this day, it stands. And, you know, it's very rarely anybody beats the All Blacks back to back. You know what I mean? So maybe Ireland might be the first team in the World Cup, and hopefully they will. But we knew there was going to be backlash. They made about 5 or 6 changes. And, you know, and there was a big issue that time. They weren't picking the lads from Auckland. Do you remember?
That's
the Whettons them. But
yeah.
And Brooke, but look, you know, it was still a great experience for us. You know what I mean? I must say that we went to New Zealand in 92 and got a tough old going over. You know what I mean? But it made us better rugby players. You know, like we came back and beat England in 93 and stuff. You know what I mean? So it was the start of something.
From a player's point of view, I remember going to the aftermatch function because you know guys like us, we bridged that amateur and that professional gap. You know, to Mike a few years longer than I would, but. Back then in 92, I remember going to the sort of the end of the tour function, and there was sort of Ford commercial, the commercialism of the All Blacks at that stage. Yeah. They were light years ahead of us, you know.
They really
were ahead of us. And I think for an awful lot of us, I remember particularly the older guys talking about this, that, you know, rugby is, you know, you'd be looking at 92, so the game was professional within 3 years.
It was, yeah.
So the movement was very much there. We were very much amateurs you know, in our whole approach because, you know, we loved rugby, but we were in it to make friends. We were in it to, you know, to enjoy ourselves. Yeah. Like,
Play the game on Saturday.
That's
3 days of a party.
Absolutely. Even a lot of the All Blacks were doing advertisements that time. I remember Sean Fitzpatrick doing an ad for beans with his mother, like, you know, I know it sounds, you know, it sounds a bit tacky, lads, but there was wedge in it back then, you know what I mean? Like she was throwing out the bins.
Yeah, that was after she'd done the Kentucky Fried Chicken ad, was it?
But like, you know, this was stuff that we hadn't seen, you know. And
It was
the way the game was going. We didn't realise it at the time.
It was a real eye-opener. I remember one of the guys, because even their physical conditioning, they were so far ahead of us. I remember there was a centre, a kid called Aroni Clark. Do you remember that name?
I
remember his shorts were huge on Nick Popplewell. And we used to call Nick Popplewell Hippo Hole, just to give you an estimation how big his backside was. And these guys were absolute monsters, you know? And it, you know, it was changing very, very quickly, you know.
It's probably actually something we don't talk about as much when we're talking about previous tours. We talk about the legacy of the Lions and the bond that's made there. And obviously, whenever we speak to former Munster players, it's about the bond that was in that group. But actually, that Irish team that went off abroad and went on those tours, probably shortening all the time. Like, is that something you look back on in your career and that those were moments that stand out as well?
Absolutely. Look, there's no doubt about it, the big days when you're winning and playing. But any rugby player from that year will tell you it's the tours was the fun. You know what I mean? You go off with fellas. We were away for 6 weeks living with each other. Like, it was just an experience. You know what I mean?
Who did you room with?
I think we kept moving around the rooms. Yeah,
I hated like, room
nobody,
with
nobody,
you.
Nobody would ever room with us twice in a row. Like, that was about it. But... it was fantastic. And like, there was no such thing as mobile phones or social media or anything back then. You know what I mean? So you had to, like, you know what I mean? You throw something on. We were safe. It was amazing. I remember somebody brought out... the whole world was safe. Let's put it that way. But somebody brought out a video of the Munster or the All-Ireland final or semi-final. No, it couldn't have been. It was a Munster championship, Tip and Cork or something. And, like, we were watching that. You know what I mean? Like, somebody was coming out on tour. They brought out the video because there was no such thing as streaming or anything like that. You know what I mean? Everything was... So we were delighted just to get something as simple as that. But definitely, yeah, New Zealand was a great experience. And, you know, you had to get on. And, okay, maybe the results mightn't have shown that it was a great tour. But in fairness, I think it would have pulled the players together and we would certainly have learned a lot from it.
What was the highlight of sharing a room with Mick Galway?
Morning.
Oh, man, the morning. Horrible, you know, underwear strewn all over the place. You know, he was rather untidy, you know, at the time, you know. So... And he loved his sort of, you know, you get up at 8 o'clock to go for, but he'd already have had room service. He'd have already had a couple of bacon sandwiches and all the rest of it. No, but yeah, there were some roommates that you would pray to have. Do you remember Brian Smith? He played out half.
Yeah.
He was an Australian guy, and Brian, he was a lovely, manly kind of guy. And how you doing, Gazza? He'd say, "I'm all right, Brian. How you doing?" And he was the only rugby player to this day. He used to come in after training and fold his dirty gear. Right, he'd fold his dirty gear, and I was bullying this kid terribly, and I'd come up and I'd empty all his gear out on the bed, and I'd say, "Will he go mad? He won't go mad." And I'd come back a couple of hours later and he'd be in there refolding. "How you doing, Gazzy?" Yeah. I was like, "Jesus, this guy never cracks. What am I going to do here?" Yeah, I was probably the worst person to room with, I would say. I probably was, you know.
We're here tonight with thanks to Heineken Rugby Club to get member-only benefits such as Heineken Champions Cup tickets, event invites, discount codes and much more. Join HeinekenRugbyClub.com right now. You can get in touch with us, hashtag OTBHRC. We're going to take a quick break, but let's give a big Dolphin round of applause for Mick Galway and Gary Halpin. You know. Delighted to welcome former Munster player Johnny Murphy to the stage. How are you?
Good.
Gary Halpin has stuck with us. Well, you're getting the music as well, Johnny.
No, thanks very much.
You didn't want to walk on.
No.
Do you want to practice it now?
No.
Do a little twirl for everybody?
No. Very hard to follow the two lads, to be fair.
We are here tonight with thanks to HeinekenRugbyClub.com. You can get discounts for the likes of Grafton Barber, Deliveroo, Captain America's, Heineken Light Tag Rugby and IMC Cinemas. Sign up today and join Heineken Rugby Club. So we're going to look ahead to the Munster game, but first I'd imagine you played a few times.
Yeah, I would have originally started, my first game down here was in 2003 with Lansdowne. We were struggling at the time and we got hammered down here. We managed just to stay up, actually beating Corcon on the last day that you see.
Playing to the crowd.
Yeah, beating Corcon last. And then when I came back then with Munster, always was a fantastic place to play in terms of surface, crowd. It really is. It was always an absolutely gorgeous pitch. Really love playing on it. And then the last couple of years I've been with Nace. Also hasn't been a happy hunting ground. I think we played them 2 years and I think we lost both times. So, you know, recently I would have played with James Collin, who, you know, probably in my time, I'd say probably Gary was probably played with the other person that, you know, Ger Earls, who's probably the best player to never get a cap. I'd say Chuck and Avari are definitely probably the best player ever to get it. Yeah, he was, you know, for 2 or 3 years, 4 years, he was our player of the season 1 year, and it was kind of mind-boggling how he never got picked for whatever reason. I think he played against the Babas over in King's Home. But, you know, he went to France and he essentially got Poe pretty much promoted on his own because they started to win away games because Chuckan was playing. And I think he's still out there now running their Esquires Academy. Chuckan. James Collin. Chuckan.
Why?
No idea. Yeah. I arrived and the name had already stuck, so I've no idea.
Did it start here in Dolphin?
Something to do with his mother.
Let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
chucking up kind of sounds like my earlier story, I thought,
Yeah, maybe it started on an away trip somewhere. Munster have done away with the dual base now in terms of training, but they do still play games between Limerick and here at Musgrave Park. Were you based in Cork or Limerick?
No, it's Limerick. We were down here 2 days, 2 days 1 week, and then 1 week, 1 day the following week. So it was mix and match, but we were generally here CIT.
You still think it was madness?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was one of those things that when the decision was going on for me, probably, you know, if they wanted to really stay a two-city province, which they are, you know, possibly placing the training centre here in Cork, you know, might have suited that model a small bit more, given that they're always going to have Thomond Park and that. But, you know, I think one thing the players really wanted when it was being finalised was that they never did lose that identity here, because it was a very happy hunting ground. I think, you know, while I was here, I think we won nearly every game here for a period of 2.5-3 years. So it really is a fantastic place to play. It's just it was before the 4G went in, it was just a really good fast track, essentially like a soccer pitch, really. You know, it was just a really, really good track.
I don't know if there's any sense that maybe Munster has lost a bit of its Corkness because they've moved the training base completely to Limerick, or still having the games here maintains that. Everyone's a little bit. Not sure.
It's a tough one to try and balance. You know, certainly they were probably the only rugby club, never mind professional, but possibly the only rugby club in the world that had you know, two centres, certainly. Mm. And, you know, when I was in Leicester, everyone, I think Julian White was the furthest that lived away from the training ground, and he had a farm about 30 minutes in the middle of Leicestershire, so everyone else was 5-10 minutes away. So when I came here and we were spending, depending on traffic, the Jack Lynch Tunnel, you could be, you know, an hour and 20 not abiding by the rules of the road, or you could be an hour and 45, you know.
So. But you're in Cork.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I love Cork. It's a really good night out, you know, and I enjoyed it down here. I did.
Did you ever come to a disco in the
No, I didn't.
You should have.
Yeah, I know. I should have. Yeah.
You should have come.
Yeah.
So Munster at 1 o'clock on Sunday, they've this double header now against Cast before Christmas that'll really go a long way to deciding where we go in the Heineken European Champions Cup. It feels as though Munster are at a pivotal point right now, because it feels like they could explode in a really positive way when you look at this team that they've named for Sunday and this back line. First time we're going to see Conor Murray and Joey Carberry on the pitch together. Keith Earls, Rory Scannell, Chris Farrell is back, Andrew Conway, Mike Haley's come in this season and done brilliantly well. It feels as though this is a team that, if they have everybody fit, could go and challenge for a Champions Cup, but that a couple of injuries could derail them, and actually it could fall apart very quickly.
Yeah, I suppose when you look at it on paper, I think you look back at what they did last year in Toulon and the raft of injuries and everything, and so that helps their belief and their thought processes going into this year, that they've been so close, and they have been quite close the last 3 or 4 years. I think certainly the last 2 years. I think it's now they have a really good balance, and when everyone's fit, they can pick and choose. And certainly in terms of a back line, you know, they can pick an all-powerful centre partnership of Chris Farrell or Jack O'Toute, or you can play off second receiver a lot more with someone like Scans at 12. Also gives you the option of a left foot. So, you know, they can mix and match. I think Sunday, I think, will go according to plan. I think it's next week is probably the big one, given that, you know, Cass were beaten at home last week for the first time in a very, very long time. So, you know, even a couple of weeks out, I think they're really going to be targeting that one back home. But in terms of this weekend, there is an excitement now, especially when you see that back line, particularly the halfbacks, and you look at the control Connor can give your team, the direction, the field position, and then you look at what Joey can bring in terms of a Maverick style and try to play. They really do have a very good balance.
So you think this Sunday should be fairly straightforward?
To a point, as it is going to be within a Heineken Cup. It's an early kickoff. Sometimes they can take a bit longer to get the atmosphere going in Thomond Park. But you know, you get a couple early scores, and then it should just roll according to plan. And I think the barometer of probably where Castrad is having Rory Cockett on the bench, I suppose, is probably the barometer of what their team are.
Just before you come in, we are actually at this point going to say goodbye to our radio listeners, but we are going to stay online for the next little while. If everyone wants to say goodbye to our radio listeners on Off the Ball and on Newstalk. We are going to be still live on Facebook Live, on YouTube, on Periscope. But before we go on the radio, I want to thank everyone at Heineken. Remember, to get member-only benefits such as Heineken Champions Cup tickets, event invites, discount codes, and much, much more, join HeinekenRugbyClub.com now. I want to thank everyone here at Musgrave Park for giving us the run of the place. To our radio audience, we have got Friday Night Racing coming up with Johnny Ward, John Duggan, and Paul Townend. So enjoy that.
Join the conversation. But text us on 53106.
We are going to stay live on all our social channels, and we're going to keep building up to the game. So you wanted to come in, Gary?
I mean, a very good point, I would think, in terms of the balance of the team and, you know, looking at rugby very much from the outside. Now, what I'm kind of beginning to like about this Munster team, in the front, second, if you go through the team, you got guys like Kilcoyne in the front row, you got Billy Holland in the second row, you've got seasoned campaigners right throughout that team now, who have been there with the good and they've been there with the bad.
Certainly,
and there is young talent there. So, and I got a real feeling looking at them in their last outing, things are really beginning to click for them. And I would be really optimistic. I think Munster are going to do very well this year.
And I think that kind of, as you say, Gary, I think the cutthroat nature that they have now in terms of picking that side that they picked last week against Edinburgh to, you know, get those internationals back embedded straight away, really kind of lays down a marker in terms of where they want to go. And I think the bad times now that they've experienced really are really going to stand to those guys, as Gary says. And, you know, they're really, really hungry for a medal, for a piece of silverware.
Just on that centre partnership then that you were talking about, and the options that Johan van Graan has, and because we're here in Dolphin and with Rory Scannell, you're talking about him as a possible second receiver, and Jacques Otaude is more of a big beast in there. Chris Farrell, quite similar. As a coach, how do you see that decision process going? Is it horses for courses, certain games? Like, are there big games that Rory Scannell may lose out in?
Probably to a sense, in terms of that's what you want within your squad, and it's trying to develop a style of play that suits you best against the opposition, and between professional organisations can jump in and out. It's not a club level where you have what you have and you have to make do with it, where here you can develop one way of playing on a Monday, Tuesday, and then hone it in on a Thursday, and then completely flip the next week because you're playing a different style of defence and a different pack. So it can be done quite easily, and I think that might be the case, but certainly with Scans, it gives you the luxury that your bench can change. So you can have, essentially, you don't have to have a specialised 10 on the bench if Scans involved, because he can click in there to 10, which gives you a few more options around your back row and possibly having an extra forward and so on. So his versatility really stands to Munster, but also for him personally going forward into World Cup year, gives Joe Smith and the likes, if he does hit a bit of form, that he can push himself for that 31-man squad, because you're, and that's why someone like Will Addison is so important to the overall Irish scheme, because he can play from 12 out. Having the luxury of guys that can play multiple positions make a big, big difference.
Yeah. Looking at that out-half partnership then, first time we're going to see it in a Munster red, Carberry and Murray together. They've had some time together with Ireland previously. Are they both at such a level, in particular Conor Murray at such a level, that whoever slots in at 10 beside him, it's going to click instantly, or do we need to be patient?
I'd say you probably need to be patient. You look at Tadhg Byrne's introduction into the whole squad, and you know he had good performances, but you look at his performances over the last 6 weeks, starting with the last two rounds of Heineken Cup, and his level, it'll always take you 2 or 3 weeks to find your feet within an organisation and then push on. But with a pairing at halfback that is so pivotal to the game, it does take a while to embed itself. But they would have played a lot. They closed out a game over in Chicago. They've done it a good few times for Ireland. So, you know, I expect this one probably to hit the ground a small bit quicker than other ones.
I've got some bad news. Dolphin have just conceded a try, and it's been converted. Who are they playing?
Musgrave.
Right. Lock the doors. Don't let them back in. No chance.
Talk to us then about Carberry and what you've seen of him so far since going to Munster. Like, is he living up to the hype? Is he starting to make that as
Yeah, definitely. I think you look at individual moments that he's had in terms of skill level, you know, his pass out the back, that everyone has shown and seen a million memes of over social media. He just gives you a point of difference that Munster probably haven't had. And, you know, losing someone like Simon Zebo, who had that X factor, just really, it really does compensate for that. I think it'll improve. He'll improve probably more as a player, I personally believe, with more game time and certainly playing with Connor for longer. And, you know, speaking to the lads, he's taken to the Munster way of life and everything like a duck to water. You know, he's, the minute his bag dropped, he was getting slag and he was giving as good as he got coming back. So that's really important, and he's settling very well. And you know, I think it's a partnership. He seems to be in it for the long haul. It's a partnership that could be in situ for a long, long time.
Munster, so many things have gone on over the last 3 or 4 years that it's been very hard to get any real momentum. But now with Johan van Graan and getting Joey Carberry in and getting these players back to fitness and the addition of Tadhg Byrne, when you look at where they are now compared to a year ago and van Graan was just starting out and was just really trying to, I guess, keep the show on the road as much as anything else. Like, do you look at Munster now and think, yeah, this is very much Johan van Graan's side? I pretty much know what to expect every week they go out.
Yeah, I think so. But I think they're also layering every, you know, every month, every 2 months, because there is a very much a young coaching ticket there. And, you know, someone like Felix is always trying to improve. He spent a lot of time away doing some career development. He was down in New Zealand this summer. He's been all over the world trying to upskill himself. So you'll see that the further that and the longer that they're in situ, those developments will come. And it'll be little add-ons, and they'll layer throughout, you know, be able to layer their attack throughout.
That dynamic is interesting with someone like Felix Jones, who everybody you talk to in Munster, they rave about him. And as you say, he's going around, he's educating himself, he's doing all the right things. Yet, and we're probably as guilty as anyone, when we talk about future Munster coaches, it's O'Gara and O'Connell, the guys who've gone abroad, who spread their wings, and are the legends of Munster. And maybe Felix Jones gets forgotten about in that conversation. Maybe that's not right.
I would 100% agree, but for Felix himself, I'd say he's happy to go under the radar for a while. He kind of got thrown in there a lot earlier than was expected, and originally the job that he was potentially to get wasn't involved in the first team. So, and then he had, and that's the character of the man. It's his personality. He met Rassi just a meeting. And Rassi decided after the meeting that he wanted to involve with the first team. He always had a very good thought process around the game. He was someone that was always quite vocal, but was extremely well respected from old to young within the group. And I think you saw his influence on how they played very early because of the aerial attack that they had, both offensively and defensively. And now you see that they have that in their armory, but they're moving forward with different things and little add-ons throughout. So he's a very shrewd operator.
Gary, you've been living over in England for quite a long time. You're just back. You're working in Roscrea?
Yes, Roscrea College. Yeah.
And what's your sense of where Irish rugby is on your return?
It's, you know, again, watching it from the outside, the thing that I am amazed about all the time when I'm looking back, you know, looking at these players, it's the genuine level, the depth we're getting in certain positions. I think Joel Schmidt said he's looking for the World Cup to have three bona fide people for each position on the field. And with the second row of Byrne coming back to Munster now, I was actually living in Wales for the last 10 years. And I watched him a lot with Clonethly. I wasn't living too far from there. And he's a guy who, you know, he's typical of so many Irish guys. They go away, they come back for a while. And like you said, his performances over the last 6 weeks have been immense, I think. Mm. You know, I've really, really liked him as a player. And I don't know Keith Earls at all. I've never met him. I knew his dad when I played against him. But he is, I mean, if any young rugby player, you know, if you want to show, you know, somebody to aspire to, because I've thought Keith Earls would finish a couple of years ago, and he just comes back, and he comes back with better and better performances all the
time.
Why
do you think he'd finish a couple of years ago?
Because there was a time there where by comparison to the players around him, he probably didn't play as well as he would be for his own. You know, I thought he might have been sort of on the edge of maybe getting dropped off the team, but just when you expect him, he just bounces back and puts in fantastic performances. I mean, he's a real tiger, the guy is. I mean, the way he just keeps fighting and fighting and fighting, I think he's a remarkable player. He's probably one of when you're looking from the outside looking in, he's a guy who I would, he's the person I'd most like to meet, I suppose, in Irish rugby.
We'll try and arrange it.
Yes,
it could be quite a meeting, I'd imagine. On one of these nights, hopefully, we might get you down to Limerick. Just working on schools level then, because we hear so much about the Leinster school system and this conveyor belt of talent that's coming through. From what you've seen in your year or so at Ross Grey, compared to what was in Wales and compared to what was around Britain, like, where is the Irish school system?
It's the real strength. A lot of the strength of the Irish system is within the schools. And probably, you know, as I said, I was in Wales for the last 10 years. And in Wales, they have polarized the rugby players to four or five schools. In Ireland, we have a better spread of it, and we're much, much better at identifying talent here. And when you look at the pure numbers of rugby, there are in excess of 150,000 people playing rugby in Wales. There's over 300,000 people playing rugby in England. Our numbers are what, 40, 50,000 maybe? So when you look at it in terms of pure numbers, the job we're doing to be competitive and to be in that, you know, the upper echelons of world rugby, it's a phenomenal achievement, and it's a job that's been very, very well done. And regardless of what we say, it has to be recognised. So
is the problem then in Wales that, and maybe in England as well, that it's been funneled too tightly, that because it's all boils down to a small amount of schools, there's too much of a drop-off of talented players?
For example, within the Irish system, if you come up through the junior club system or you come up through the youth system, you have a very, very, you have a good chance, if you're good, to make it all the way to the top. It's more difficult in Wales to go that route today. Just because you have the Cardiff Blues, the Dragons, and so on, and they get their talent in, and they tell kids, go to that school, go to that school, and they're all within a couple of miles of the training ground, and as a result, these guys pull them in from sort of 15, 16 years of age, and they're almost full-on professionals before they even become professionals. And it's very hard, in the life of any athlete, it's very hard to maintain a professional mindset. You know, 18, like, we really get serious with them in Ireland at 18. We do an awful lot of assessing prior to that, but from 18 forward is when it really gets competitively serious. Whereas, you know, in the world, you know, the Cardiff Blues have a Cardiff Blues under 14s and under 15s, and these kids are, you know, I think we do it better because the people are cared for better in terms of the amount they play and so on.
It's like the English model, very similar. You know, they get assessed in these EPDGs at 13, 14, and then they get brought into, they're in the academy ages in England are 16, 17, 18. So you're telling a sixth year student essentially, so sixth former going into his first year in college, you're out of the academy. And he's like, all right,
what do I do now?
I'm going to be a professional rugby player. What am I supposed to do now? Where in Ireland, the assessment starts probably 2 years later, 15, 16, when they come out of Junior Cup or youths under 15 or under 16s. But you have guys that don't get picked for the Irish under 18s, A's or B's, or in that kind of big kind of 80-man squad. Sure. But there could be another 10 or 15 guys that might get picked for the Irish under 20s a year later because they're playing club rugby, they play really well, they're in and out. And an academy guy, third-year academy in Ireland, is essentially a 20, 21-year-old. So they've given them 3 years development that's longer rather than at 18, right, you're gone.
Decision.
And as Gary says, when you're in the professional sphere for so long already at 18 and you have your first kind of knockback, a lot of guys will go, we're not on the radar. They kind of go, well, fuck that. Like, I'm done. You know, like, he'll just, you know, the first sense of, you know, resilience or whatever, guys will just go, I'm out. Well, you know,
it's the effect you have on a kid at 18 or 19 telling you, essentially what you're saying is you failed.
Yeah.
And this is what I, you know, in all systems, I think, suffer this to a great extent because, and even there's a certain amount of it in Ireland, probably not as much as other countries, but you see, as a school teacher and working, you know, with coaching with kids, what I want kids to do, what I judge as a successful rugby career, is that when you leave school, you go to college, you go to a club, and you take up playing in that club, and you make friends, and you get on, and sort of feed back into that grassroots, as it were, because that's what's really happening. That's where the real loss of player is. Those guys who are being told at 19, sorry, you're failed, they think they're no good then, but they don't realise how good they already are just to be there,
they
you know?
They can come back and be the best player at the club.
And it's really, you can never underestimate how easily kids think that. Because I remember being a player in London Irish, and I remember sitting down, I was really, really annoyed about, I'm really feeling sorry for myself after game, we really did badly, and I was like, and then I realised, hold on, you're actually playing in the top division in an English, well, Courage League or whatever else. There must be hundreds of guys out there that would give their right arm. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's that kind of, they lose the sense of perspective and they quit the game and they're lost forever. That's the greatest shame about it.
I think myself and Dunner have spoken about it before. It's the, you know, and I say this to the kids that leave our school in St. Mary's. I say, guys, and exactly like I just said, my goal is that you play rugby and you play rugby for a long, long time. Because most clubs have seniors, J1s, J2s, J3s. Some clubs in Dublin go the whole way, have 10 teams between women and men. But, like, you don't realise that on a Friday night, those guys come in here and they talk to someone, he might give you a job, you know, or you meet someone and then you end up being involved in the whole thing all over again and the cycle keeps going. It's when we lose people out of the game, that's the biggest shame. And I think that's really important, that the grassroots of the game is really pushed forward so that, you know, there's a place for everyone, because rugby's built on volunteerism, really. Mm-hmm. So there's a place for absolutely everyone in your local club, regardless of where you are. And I think that is really, really, really important.
I think actually there's a question from the crowd. Is there behind you, Ronan, there? Literally sitting right behind you.
I agree, but I just on what Gary was saying, you know, you're living over in Wales, and Irish rugby seems to be very self-congratulatory based on the fact that their professional teams are doing very well. But, like, it would seem to me that, well, I don't know about Welsh rugby, but is club rugby, community rugby in Wales, you know, failing because there are, you know, less successful than Irish community club rugby is? Because it would seem to me, and I'm not a member of a rugby club, but, you know, years ago the AIL was very successful and it doesn't seem to be quite as big now. And is Irish rugby very congratulatory at the top level but missing something at the bottom level where Welsh and English clubs maybe, you know, are not doing that badly relative? Do you know what I'm trying to say? Very badly.
In Wales and England, I mean, they're much, much closer to being national games for a start. So you're always going to get more people. There are always going to be groups of people who will play in junior clubs. The guys who I'm referring to are those guys who don't quite make the grade professionally. They're the guys that need to go back to the clubs to lift the, you know, if those guys are coming back in mass to clubs, they would be lifting standards better in a general sense, is the point that I would be making. And I think, there is, you know, club rugby, localised rugby in Wales is huge because it's kind of like hurling is in Ireland. Rugby is, you know, if you're making it, so they're a little bit different to compare when you're talking about grass. The grass level in Wales would be quite different to the grass level in Ireland. I'm just talking about those professionals really who don't make it.
I do think you probably have a point in terms of the investment that needs to be shown in the club game. There's a lot of stuff going on at the moment, and it's coming from all sides. And I'm a part of probably the negotiation process for one, you know, Division One clubs, and then there's, you know, Division Two clubs. There is things that need to happen, and you know, some people took it as an insult. Some people took it as a compliment that, you know, in the RFU document that was published last year, that it said that, you know, the third tier of Irish rugby is the clubs. And I think that's actually a good thing, because they have to realise that it goes, you know, and they do know that it goes international, provincial clubs, and then it goes club, you know, your AIL clubs and so on. And I think there is talk of a reshuffle and more investment in the game. It's just about trying to do it in the correct way. It's getting everyone around a table and having a conversation that needs to happen, but it's trying to find the correct way to do it, because there's so many different agendas and different wants for all clubs around the place. But I do think that the club game is at a turning point now, that if we can get it right, then the club game is here to stay. If it goes wrong, then I think there's going to be an issue. But like, for instance, you know, I can say it, probably I'm not on the radio and you're not allowed to use this either tomorrow, but there's a different idea from, you know, what Leinster want to what Munster want. And Connacht want something and then Munster want. So the professional game boards all have different ideas of how they want to, some want to use the club game, some don't want to use the club game at all. So how does someone like David Nusafora balance those conversations in a room? So that's the issue at the moment for the club game.
And what's a successful club game for you? So say in 5 years, where it could be if the negotiations go well, like what were the improvements you think we could see in the club game?
A club game that if you have, for instance, Dolphin playing Nace here on a Saturday and there's no A game and both Scanlon brothers are coming back from injury, they get 40 minutes out there, and the Nace guys like Adam Byrne and James Connolly, who are playing for Connacht and Leinster, they're coming back from injury and they're playing out here rather than getting no game time, and they come into an A structure so that the pros use the club game and it's used to develop the young academy guys so that they have an affiliation to the club, and that the whole league goes up a standard rather than dropping down the ladder.
Is that not quite unrealistic, because the Scannels are Ireland internationals? They are professional. You would never imagine a professional soccer player going back to an amateur team just to get his fitness up.
No, but you're talking about developing a league that can have that and that is structured in that way. And then it's down to the individual club to have the correct things in place that it fits that. And that's important.
So just to be, when we're looking at academy players then, just so I'm clear on this, if academy players are they loaned out to clubs all the time?
Yeah, academy players essentially have a club, but in some provinces they wouldn't play, for instance. Where in Ulster, probably in terms of the professional game board, they use the clubs. So there's 5 Ulster teams in our league. So it's potluck when you play them, really. So if you could play them one weekend and they have no pros, no academy guys, no development guys, and
I think there's been a late equaliser.
Try.
Yes.
Are we heading towards 7-all, perhaps? Is this live on TV somewhere that you're watching that you've just got a better view than the rest of us? They've gone to the TMO. Are you the TMO?
And so they then play, but some provinces don't release those guys, so they only play for their A sides. So, for instance, say the Cardiff Blues A team. So those A guys would be, say, they would play for Clonetley or Neath or whatever. The but in, say, in England, you only play for Leicester A or, and so on, where here you can play for both Leinster A and a club.
Sure. Okay. Just before we finish up, and I will say we're still live on some of our social channels, but we want to chat about the topic we've been covering over the last couple of days, which was about painkillers and anti-inflammatories within rugby and within all sport. Brian O'Driscoll, I'm sure a lot of you heard, it was very good on this on Wednesday night, giving his own personal story, particularly later in his career, and his dealings with painkillers and stories of doctors walking down buses, handing them out like Smarties, and just getting to a stage of his career where he just took them as part of his pre-match routine. You were talking earlier, Gary, and you're on about the tours back in the day, and lads are literally playing, it feels, with broken legs. Was this an issue? Like, is it something now when you look back
you felt you overdid it, or is it more of a modern phenomenon?
It's not so much. It's not. I mean, in my own experience, I had a really bad, bad situation happen to me. Literally in the weeks after my first cap, I'd had a couple of injuries, and I had taken anti-inflammatory drugs, and I was taking too many of them, and I quite literally burnt a hole in my stomach, and I had a blood transfusion. I was in hospital for 10 days in the Meath Hospital all those years ago. But that was something at the time. I hadn't realized I was allergic to them as such. So that it was just one of those.
Were you self-medicating?
I wasn't self-medicating, no, but I was taking, I would have been, you know, you can take four anti-inflammatories a day, unless you go to Spain and buy the 600 mil ones, but who said that? No, but anyway. But no, it was just
because it's true.
Yeah. No, it's one of those. Oh my God, there's a Gardaí car outside waiting for me there. Anyway, it's one of these things. No, I was properly prescribed them, and I was just taking them and you could take them up to 4 or 5 days or whatever, and I just got quite ill from it. But that's, you know.
And was there any long-lasting effects from that?
I can blame my mother and my father for my poxy genes for that then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For being allergic to it, but no, there was... Yeah, but, you know, I don't think there was a big culture of it.
Like, did you find in your later days playing that it just became a matter of habit, that to get on the pitch, you needed to take something?
To be honest, I would honestly say I wouldn't have seen much evidence of that at all, but you see... You know, you're talking about a different era. And I mean, I'm terrified when I see the hits these guys are taking day in, day out. And I mean, if you look at that New Zealand game, we were up to 70 tackles, and it was like 9 minutes or something. It was ridiculous the amount of tackles we were making, and that will have a real effect on these bodies. So maybe it's going to be something of this generation of players that will, you know, it be one of the, I don't know if you want to call it a negative side effect or an effect of professionalism. I think that's one of the issues, because these guys are taking one hell of a beating. There's no doubt about it.
There are many issues within the one issue of painkillers, and there's the ethical question, which we've spoken about at length, of if it brings you from 60% to 90%, does that make it somewhat performance enhancing? But for rugby in particular, the hits, and if you're not fully feeling the effects of the hit, and you're potentially doing damage to your opponent because of that, there has to be serious questions about whether or not players should be allowed to use painkillers.
I think there's a difference between performance. I personally, so I'm just going to clear that up. I personally think, and it's that there's a difference between performance enhancing and performance enabling. Certain things happen to enable you to perform at a weekend based on lumps and bumps and knocks that you pick up. Performance enhancing lifts your bar and lifts your baseline. Now, someone is going to completely disagree with me there, but that's just my personal viewpoint. Throughout my career, you know, I was on that bus that, you know, Lewis spoke about, Lewis Moody spoke about.
Who ended up with colitis.
Colitis, yeah, and I didn't sit as far back then. I was still a young pup at then, but like in terms of, you know, a professional organization has a full-time doc. So you walk in and you say, "Doc, look at my knee," and you do a sweep on your knee and you're swollen. Right, have you iced it? Yeah. Have you elevated? Yeah. What's the story this weekend? Well, I'm hoping to play. Right. So, and you'd be like, "Well, can I have a narcoxia or a diphene?" Okay, yeah, grant. There you go. And out you'd go. Now, that happened... that would happen for me personally every now and again. I don't like taking tablets. I used to have arguments with Alan Waters, the ex-Munster guy, about taking supplements. I just hated taking supplements. So
you make it sound there like it's a very straightforward conversation, though. At any stage, does the doctor say, "Not this time"?
Yeah, well, that would be my experience. Like, it for me, yeah. Now, you go in and the door is open. Like, it's a very matter of fact conversation. What treatment have you done? What's this? What's Grant? Okay, you've tried that. You need to get rid of swelling before. So, yeah, there you go.
Since you quit, it looks like you're back onto supplements.
Yeah, that's a different kind of supplement. Different kind of supplement.
I was a bugger for the supplements. I love them,
That's one of the things like that. That was my experience of it.
I think people are always looking for, ooh, what's going on there, kind of. In my experience of rugby, and I would bet the amount of times you're tested as a rugby player. There's random tests going on in games above. They are AIL, they are European clubs, international matches. There's a lot of random testing going on in rugby.
Yeah, but I guess these are very much legal drugs that they are. It's the painkillers, the anti-inflammatories, and it's the prolonged use of them.
Yeah, my point on the performance enablers, I'd call them, so the painkillers and all that kind of stuff, is there's also a duty that you have to look after yourself, you know?
But professional sports people aren't good at that.
Yeah, and I understand that. Like, I played with a broken hand, for 2 weeks because it was contract time, and that's just, right, grit the teeth, suck it up, get on with it. You know, I had a hairline fracture in my hand, it was contract time, I was about to sign, and I was like, well, do you know what? I just have to strap a pair on here. Yeah, exactly. So, and these things happen, but there's a case where, you know, reality has to set in too, and you go, actually, I'm kind of flogging a dead horse here, you know, and that's the thing. Like, there are always going to be incidents. Like, you know, when Marcelo Alfredo was in Leicester, we played Harlequins last day of the season, and if we lost that game, we would have been knocked out of Europe. And to a club like Leicester back then, this was in 2008, would have been like, no. I played in Bath the week before, did cartilage in my knee. I got a steroid injection that week because I was like, I'm not missing this. This is the biggest game in probably the history that I'm going to be in the club. So I'm playing in this. So that was me. The following week, we actually ended up winning with a bonus point. Results got our way. I was picked to play in the semi-final ahead of Alassane Toulagni, and my knee just blew up completely. And I went, actually, I can't do, that's a sign, I can't do it again.
I think that sort of just desire to be on the field, I mean, I see this with under 13 kids, they're sick and they still want to go out on the field. You make the point about, guys who compete and they want to get involved, you know, they're involved in games. I think it's a kind of a natural thing to look for.
What happens with that 13-year-old kid who is sick? Or has a little bit of a knock.
We make a decision for him, obviously. You would. You do that. But, you see, at the same time,
Would you have concerns he's going home and he's just taking a few things and baking it and...
No, I don't think I would. And I just don't... I don't want to push it as far as, like, you know, this... by taking painkillers, it makes them somehow better. It isn't a performance-enhancing drug. It is managing pain in their body. It doesn't give them extra powers. Mm. And that's where the main point you need to understand, I think, in this. Yeah. You know, should you be taking painkillers, you know, over a prolonged period of time?
No.
You shouldn't be. I mean, that's something that obviously has to be managed. But you're not getting a competitive advantage by taking painkillers.
But you're both involved, I think, with underage players. Mm. Should underage players ever be taking painkillers to go out and play in a match?
No. Look, we have a WhatsApp group purely based for injuries. Everything is logged. Every two dislocated finger is logged in a file. The games master holds it. There's different return to play protocols through concussion, through everything, and all have to be signed off by doctors. You know, I at the start of the year with the SCT, I tell the lads, look, lads, you shouldn't be taking supplements. Look after your diet properly. Here's nutrition expertise. Use this. Don't be messing around. You know, and that's just how we run our program. So
that's in every school. The scrutiny is, and it's rightly so, there. We do not encourage. We don't allow kids to take supplements, vitamin supplements, as a boarding school. Anything that comes through our mail will be picked up, and I tend to give it back to the parents. I do give it back to parents. We don't. particularly in the schools and the club system. In schools, we probably see them a little bit more, but everybody is switched on to behaving and acting accordingly in relation to this whole area. Mm. It's very, very specific, and we have really, really good guidelines of what's proper procedure.
I think we're going to have to leave it there, lads. I'm sure you're all desperate to get out and support the J2s for the final half an hour there. It sounds like it's going to be an absolute cracker. Did they kick the conversion? Do we know?
No. Oh. Guys, has anybody got any painkillers? My knees are killing me here.
You're in the rugby club. You're in the right place. Give it up for Gary Halpin and for Johnny Murphy. My thanks again to everybody here at Dolphin for the warm welcome we've received. Thanks a lot for having us. Safe home, everybody. Go out and enjoy the rest of your night. We have been here with thanks to HeinekenRugbyClub.com. We'll talk to you again on tomorrow's Off the Ball. Good luck.